Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us here on This Week in Iowa. I'm Sabrina Ahmed. We start this morning with a discussion on hemp production. The 2018 Farm Bill legalized growing hemp once a program is in place. So this week, the USDA put out the rules that states will have to follow for that program. Iowa changed our laws to align with the Farm Bill this year and then set out to write our own set of rules. Now, Iowa rules must align with those federal guidelines that were just released. I spoke to Iowa's Ag Secretary Mike Knegg about the next steps.
We're really close. We knew a lot of what USDA was going to do, but we really do now need to, we'll have to look at the rule package. It's 161 pages, and so we're digesting that and really looking at it. But, you know, for the most part, we think our plan very well tailored to the USDA program. Just need to make a few changes. We expect to make our application to USDA within the next month, certainly within the next couple of weeks. And then we will have state rules that will have to go through the process. But the good news is, I think we're very much on track to have a fully approved, fully functioning program for 2020 growing season.
But 2020 growing season, decisions have to be made by farmers right now.
Well, true. And so I think, again, that's we're getting that message out that, again, that the wheels are in motion now, the USDA rules, our plan is in play, or, you know, will be in place. We'll have approval, hopefully, by the end of the year from USDA. Our rules package will go into effect. And then growers will know what they need to do to comply. And yes, there will be some things that they will have to wait and see. But for the most part, again, we know that folks know that there's a 40-acre cap, for instance, on what they can grow. And really, we've been trying to be really upfront with producers saying, you know, you really have to understand what you're getting into here. We know we can grow hemp, but can you get paid for the end product? And so those are the types of things that farmers can be looking at now if they're interested. And also identifying what are the sources of seeds or plants that they might want to use. But again, we don't have an approved program in the state of Iowa yet, but fully expect to by the 2020 growing season.
So can farmers, if they find a product that they want to start purchasing in order to plant once our program is implemented, can they start making that purchase now, or would that still technically be illegal?
Well, I think it's so to right now, because we still don't have an approved USDA program and we don't have Iowa rules in place, it is still illegal to cultivate or handle material related to hemp as of right now. And so again, that's why we're moving as quickly as we can now that we've got these USDA rules to get our program approved. But that's a really important point, that as of right now, until we have that USDA approval, the product is still illegal in the state of Iowa.
What are you hearing? Obviously, this all has to be anecdotal because it isn't a fully functioning program, but are you hearing that farmers are interested in this? Are they planning? Are they setting aside 40 acres to do this?
You know, you've got really folks across the board. We've got existing farmers that I think will be interested and they'll take some land and do this. I think folks will start small. At least I would encourage folks to start small and know what we're getting into. Again, that end market is still very much unknown. You know, CBD, which we've talked about before, is still very much in question. So FDA still has not approved CBD as a food or feed ingredient. So it is still not legal from a federal level standpoint to use that product. And so there's a question mark there. Hemp fiber can be used in a lot of materials, but, you know, those supply chains are not well established. So there's still a lot of work to be done on that processing and that end use side of things, but I think there's opportunity here. So yes, we've got people from all across the board looking at it. So maybe some new farmers, beginning farmers, some existing farmers. Again, we would just caution, regardless of what your situation is, do your homework and really know what you're getting into before you start down the path.
So just to reiterate, the legalization of growing hemp in Iowa does not legalize CBD.
That is correct. The program that USDA rolled out relates to cultivating the crop and handling the material. Our package, our program and our rules for the Department of Agriculture will be related to cultivating and handling that crop. The processing side of it and those end uses, especially with CBD, is very much still an open question. Well, it's not even an open question, really, because FDA has not approved it for a feeder food use. Now, there's lots of conversations about that, and we would certainly argue, and I know my colleagues across the country are pushing FDA to take some action and provide some guidance so that folks, it's not a complete mystery about where they are or even what a timeline might be to get that kind of approval. So a lot of questions still on CBD, but really the source of that information is going to have to be FDA.
Farmers must pass a background check before they can be part of this program. The RFS took center stage this week in Michigan at a meeting with the EPA. Ag Secretary Mike Nagy spoke about the EPA keeping promises the Trump administration made to farmers here in Iowa. It happened in a room full of RFS supporters and a small group of the oil lobby. But the head of the EPA was not there. I spoke to Ag Secretary Mike Nagy about where the RFS stands now.
Renewable fuel standard envisions that there should be a certain level of ethanol and biodiesel that is blended into the nation's transportation fuel system. Now, so you'll hear us talk a lot about when 15 billion gallons is guaranteed, that we ought to have 15 billion gallons that is actually blended. What's happened over the last several years, and this started several years ago, is that EPA began to grant small refinery exemptions, waivers to that process. So a refinery and some refineries that are owned by some big names, Exxon and others, claiming financial hardship in complying with the renewable fuel standard. So just for example, in August, 31 waivers were granted that totaled 1.4 billion gallons worth of ethanol. So 15 billion gallons is what we're supposed to blend, and EPA waives 1.4 billion gallons. We have a 13.6 billion gallon blend level. And that's not delivering on certainly congressional intent of the renewable fuel standard, but it's not delivering on what the president had agreed to as well and has said about supporting the RFS. What needs to happen is that we're not arguing that EPA can't grant those waivers. We're just saying that when they grant waivers, that those gallons waived should be redistributed to other blenders so that we, again, live up to and meet that standard, that level that Congress and that the president wants EPA to enforce. And so what we're disagreeing on right now is how to calculate that redistribution. EPA wants to use Department of Energy recommendations, and we think they should go back and actually look at the actual waivers that they granted and take an average of those and apply those to future years. So if on average you're granting over a billion gallons of waivers, then you ought to redistribute a billion gallons in next year's renewable fuel standard level. So we're arguing over that piece, and it's important. I think what we want to see is that 15 billion gallons means 15 billion gallons, and that EPA lives up to the law.
So the president made this promise. Mm-hmm. The president has appointed Andrew Wheeler.
Yes.
Andrew Wheeler is not keeping up with the president's promise. Senator Joni Ernst has blamed Andrew Wheeler personally and said this is all his fault. But at what point is it also the president's fault? And at what point is enough enough?
Well, so on one hand, I'll step back and say, okay, so we're in a process, right? EPA has proposed a rule. They are in a comment period, which means that rules can change. So the final rule, we expect, you know, they'll go through a 30-day public comment period. They'll review those rules, and by the end of the calendar year, we expect to have a final rule. So I guess the first message is this isn't done yet. We think we can actually get the change, and it's not that big of a change. Actual waiver, actual gallons waived versus Department of Energy recommendations. EPA's never followed Department of Energy recommendations. Why would they start following them now in this context? And so we think it's actually a relatively simple fix. But I think it's true that every time the president gets involved directly in the renewable fuels issue, things seem to go in the positive direction. Go back and look at E15. The president really delivered that and created a lot of optimism in the industry, sent a signal for growth. I think it is going to be important for the White House to get directly involved in this as well, and I think that's what it perhaps will take here in the next month to get that. But let's even zoom out just a little further. This is one issue, and it's an important one, and we should get it right. But it's sort of a one in a series of things that we need to continue to work on to strengthen the renewable fuels standard. You know, we need to make sure that the E15 rules get put into place properly. And even if we get everything we want through this process, we're going to have to continue to fight for this industry. The opponents of the renewable fuels industry are alive and well in Washington, D.C., and it's going to require us to continue to lead and to be advocates for the industry.
What happens if this change isn't put into place?
Well, I'm still hopeful it can be, and we're going to work towards that goal. And I think it's going to be critically important that over the next month that we use every opportunity to make that voice heard both at the White House and within the EPA and USDA as well. And we need to do that. So one, I'm still hopeful that this fix can be done in a way that meets our expectations, but also lives up to the deal that was negotiated with the White House. I think the good news is that we are now envisioning that when waivers are granted, that there has to be an accommodation for that on the other side. That's already a win. Now, that's an important piece that we need to not forget about. But we won't be sending the kind of signal that we need to send to the industry that there's certainty going forward unless we get this done right.
Secretary Naig says this comment period is the time for Iowans to make their voices heard. And we are joined now by Peter Hansen, an associate professor at Grinnell College, to talk about a recent Grinnell Seltzer National poll released that talked about impeachment, of course, among other issues. What, in terms of impeachment, were you looking for from the people who you spoke to?
Well, we really wanted to break this down into its component parts. We wanted to know people's opinions on the underlying conduct, as well as what they thought about impeachment itself. So the very first thing we did was to ask our respondents whether they thought it was okay or not okay for a political candidate to ask a foreign government for assistance in an election. Now, our findings here were fascinating.
Okay.
80% of the public, everybody, said it was not okay for a political candidate to do this. Democrats, Republicans, independents, key demographic groups that support President Trump, like rural voters. There's no one that thinks it's okay for a candidate for office to do this.
But as far as the impeachment inquiry itself is concerned, that's kind of a different story.
Very different. So here we see the partisan divide we've grown used to reappearing. 80% of Democrats were in favor of the impeachment inquiry. In fact, 80% of Democrats are ready for the president to be removed from office. Correspondingly, Republicans were opposed both to the inquiry itself and to the thought that the president might be removed from office.
Okay, now what else did you touch on in terms of impeachment? Did you touch on anything as like some of these more niche-y things, like whether these hearings should be public or anything along those lines?
No, we didn't get into the nuts and bolts of the process. That's because we really wanted to look at the major principles at stake. Mm-hmm. That's why we started out asking about the underlying conduct. You know, what do you think about what the president has done here? And what we've seen is a disconnect between what people think of the action and what the consequence should be.
So what does that mean?
Well, I think it really explains a lot about the debate we're seeing playing out in Congress mm-hmm. right now, where Republicans have been heavily critical of the process, you know, that Democrats to date have conducted their depositions in secret. Of course, that changed now with the Democrats actually voting to begin a public impeachment process. I think it explains why Republicans haven't wanted to engage on the substance of the question. It's because even their own voters recognize that this behavior is not okay.
Okay, so moving forward, how can this poll be implemented when our congressional leaders and our senators and even the president are taking into account what the American people actually think?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because the real question is what happens if the House actually impeaches the president? Formally, the next step in the process then is that the Senate would have to hold a trial.
Right.
Well, the question is, what are senators going to do? And I think the clear signal from our poll right now is that Republican voters are sticking with the president. Now, that means Republican senators, if they're listening to their voters, are not going to have a very strong incentive to vote to convict him.
Even if they think what he did was wrong.
Well, that's right. I mean, what we know about members of Congress is that first and foremost, they're interested in keeping their constituents happy. And it's hard to see a large number of Republican senators going against their voters.
Okay, so how do you think this plays out then? And then, I mean, obviously, I know you're a political scientist. You're not a politician, but do you think that that means moving forward that the Senate won't take it up at all?
No, I think they will take it up. In fact, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that they certainly will do that. But the real question is, what will they do after seeing the evidence that's presented? Our data suggests that, at least I would be somewhat surprised if Republican senators went against their voters. So the real question is, how are Republican voters going to respond to what's presented?
Coming up next, we continue talking about this same poll, but this time, a topic that is not divided on party lines, criminal justice reform. Continuing our discussion this morning about that national poll released this week, we are switching gears a little bit and joined now by Assistant Professor Logan Lee with Grinnell College, now talking about the criminal justice reform portion of the poll. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, so kind of give me a quick breakdown of what this poll was trying to accomplish in terms of criminal justice reform. What were those two questions that were asked?
Yeah, so the first question we asked was just, why do we incarcerate people? So this is a very simple question, but surprisingly, it's something that we don't really know. It's not something that typically gets asked. And we gave people three possible options. We lock people up just to get them off the street, make us safer. We lock people up to punish them, or we lock people up to rehabilitate them.
And what was the answer that got the most buzz, if you will?
Yeah, of those three, it seemed to just be the incarceration to get people off the street and make us safer. That was the thing that people were most excited about, or
okay,
at least thought that was the reason why.
And what was the second question that was asked?
So the second question said, mass incarceration is a big deal in the United States. We're number one in incarceration rates in the world. And so here are four potential policies that could reduce that. And then the specific policies were to reduce sentences for violent criminals, especially first-time violent criminals, to offer judges an opportunity to reassess people who they've convicted, and then to release people who they deem to have been rehabilitated, to stop sending people back to prison for parole violations when they haven't committed a new crime. Oh, shoot, the fourth one is not coming to me immediately.
Well, that's okay, but so what was the consensus? What did people think was the best policy?
So in general, the one that was really popular was, the one I've forgotten. How handy that is. Actually using alternatives to incarceration. So this is things like electronic monitoring, home imprisonment, things like that.
Okay,
that was the most popular.
What was the goal of these two questions? What were you trying to get at?
So the goal was, we're kind of in a moment where there are a lot of people who think mass incarceration is a bad idea.
Yeah.
That seems to be broadly popular. But we don't have as much information about how we fix it, right? And there's a lot of potential policies. And so from this, one of the things we can help us to understand is that things like electronic monitoring and incarceration in the home might be very easy to get political support for.
Okay, so how does this potentially impact 2020 as we look into not just the presidential race, but also other congressional and Senate races as well?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most striking things about our results was that there was broad support for these initiatives, and it actually wasn't at all tied to whether the person had voted for President Trump in 2016. It was the only poll question that had no correlation between sort of party affiliation and how they felt about this. So I think it's an opportunity for really any candidate on either side of the aisle to come out strongly in support of some of these criminal justice reforms and really see a boost in their number that would be a bipartisan thing.
Now, was there any sort of discussion as to which candidates maybe might be best when you're talking about criminal justice reform, who's put the best policies forward?
So we didn't ask about that specifically. And certainly, you know, in the presidential election,
right,
you can look at the individual Democratic primary candidates,
yes,
or President Trump. And there have been a lot of different policies, mm-hmm, out there. President Trump has actually already signed the First Step Act, which I think most economists and criminologists are excited about. It's a step in the right direction. But ultimately, if we're going to make real progress on criminal justice, we're going to have to do it at the state level. That's where almost something like 85% of all people incarcerated are incarcerated by states. So regardless of, you know, what the president candidates say, they can only change federal policy. It's going to make not a huge amount of difference.
Oh, very interesting. At a state level. Well, Logan Lee, thank you so much for being here. We really
appreciate
your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the This Week in Iowa podcast. You can find the This Week in Iowa podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, so be sure to subscribe now. You can also watch This Week in Iowa every Sunday at 9 a.m. on Local 5. For the latest in Iowa political news, follow This Week in Iowa on Twitter or visit weareiowa.com.